Welcome to home. Welcome to the second hour of our program. It doesn't feel exactly like the second hour because we've had some interruptions this morning, necessary interruptions, covering some press conferences related to the shooting, the tragic shooting in Buffalo. We've been given the clear go-ahead for the second hour now, and so we will proceed. We were attempting an interview with the rep from the Metropolitan Water District that cut a little short, but I got the info to you nonetheless. We're talking today about our current water crisis affecting millions of Southern Californians. And here is my position on it. It's very, very simple. Yeah, we're in a crisis. Yeah, we've got to tighten our belts in some ways. But ultimately, if we handle this the right way, I don't want you to panic. We don't have to throw our hands up and give up and say we're going back to becoming a desert, because in actuality, as we're going to discuss with our next guest here in just a moment, we never were a desert, and we still aren't a desert, and we're not going to become a desert unless we handle all of this the wrong way. So our goal is to change the way we live here in Southern California to become, maybe for some of us, the first time ever, true Southern Californians. And I feel like we've got an open mic still somewhere in traffic. Let's close that down and get back to our program. Thank you very much. All right. Katie Tilford is the certified horticulturalist and executive assistant at the Theodore Payne Foundation out here in the San Fernando Valley, in Sun Valley, actually, not too far from the KFI studios. Just if you're wondering, what is the Theodore Payne Foundation and where are they? Well, where they are is just on the other side, the north side of the 5 freeway, kind of across the freeway from the Burbank Airport, right here near Burbank, California, technically Sun Valley. What is the Theodore Payne Foundation? The Theodore Payne Foundation is a nonprofit nursery and educational foundation having to do with native plant materials. And what I want to do is dive in, and I've got Katie Tilford on the line, and let's have a conversation about what we can do in regards to native plants. All right, let me try and do this, make sure I haven't messed anything else up. Katie, are you there with me?
Yes. Hey, Dean. So happy to be here.
I'm so glad you're on the program. You know what? I have been wanting to get you guys on. I've mentioned the foundation so many times in the course of doing landscape design shows and so on. And I just thought, you know what? Now is the perfect opportunity because we're in the middle of this renewed water crisis here in Southern California. And it raises this subject, which is one of my not only pet peeves of design for Southern California, and that is that people have too many exotics in their planting plans. Exotics, not meaning that the plants came from Fiji, but exotics in the technical sense that they don't belong here in California. They come from somewhere other than California. And not that that's the worst thing in the world, but when all of your planting comes from somewhere other than California, then suddenly we find ourselves in this situation where we are pouring way more water onto plants than we need to be because they come from places where, you know, you don't even need sprinklers to keep them green. That's number one problem. There are layers and layers of problems. Habitat is a whole nother problem. Our native insects and birds and the use that they have for plants that don't belong to this region that they haven't co-evolved with. Anyway, I'm going to let you get into some of that with us, but I am just so glad that you're with me because I want to introduce everybody to the Theodore Payne Foundation. Why don't you give us just a quick overview of what Theodore Payne is all about?
Yeah, thanks so much, Dean. And you just mentioned a lot of great ideas that I want to unpack. First of all, I will explain that Theodore Payne Foundation is a nonprofit. We were established in 1960, and we're out here in Sun Valley on 22 acres of canyon land in Southern California. And our mission is to teach people about how great California native plants are, but also to inspire them. So we have some really beautiful gardens here on our property, and it's free to enter. Anyone on our sales staff will be happy to come and talk to you if you come by, and it's just a great place to learn and also be inspired.
Now, you are a nonprofit organization, but you do have a nursery and you do sell plants and seeds, but you also educate. So you kind of, you know, ride the fence there in between the two, yes?
Yes, we do both of those things. And, you know, we are definitely proponents of climate appropriate gardening, which you mentioned. A lot of times in the industry, gardeners and nurseries are promoting plants that require summer rain or would normally get summer rain in their neighborhood. In Southern California here and a lot of, you know, the Western U.S., we have dry summers. So we want to set up gardeners for success, to plant things that make sense for their climate. And so that is a lot of what we're trying to teach people about here. That if you plant native plants, you will be helping the environment and the ecosystem. You'll also be making your life easier.
Gotcha. Now, let's explode one myth right off the bat. When I tell a client, hey, let's go California native with our landscaping, 8 out of 10 times they're going to look at me and say, what, cactus?
Yeah, that is a huge myth. And I'm really glad you brought that up. Even, you know, a lot of professional people in the industry will talk about California is a desert. We got to plant desert plants, cactus and succulents, like you talked about. But most of what you see, if you're, say, you're out hiking in Southern California, you're going to be seeing a chaparral plant community or a coastal sage scrub. So those are plants that have deep roots. They like lean soils with not a lot of nutrients. They like a fast draining soil. And they're drought tolerant, so they want a dry summer, which is really counterintuitive. A lot of us think, oh, it's hot, I'm thirsty, my plants must be thirsty too. But if you go out hiking, you'll notice all these plants that only get natural rainfall and they're still alive. So we definitely want to raise awareness about coastal sage scrub and chaparral communities. And there are actually a ton of plant communities other than desert in California. And the main word to know, the buzzword is Mediterranean climate. So there's 5 Mediterranean climates around the world, including the western coast of California. You also have the coast of Chile, South Africa, southern and western Australia, and then of course the Mediterranean in Europe. So these are all places that have a wet period in the winter and then a dry period in the summer,
okay,
which is really key to selecting good plants.
Okay, so that's exactly what I wanted you to say. because now, California has deserts. We have some desert areas, but by and large, most of Southern California, especially coastal Southern California, is not a desert.
That's right. California is not a desert.
It
only
is
certain parts of it are.
It is a coastal Mediterranean climate, like many other regions across the world, and our planting classification chaparral, which, and you said some really amazing words there that I want everybody to hear. I want everybody to hear.
Yeah.
Deeply rooted plants that don't require a lot of water, that do well in really poor soil conditions with very little nutrients.
A poor soil. That's right. They don't want fertilizer.
It's a gardener's dream.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Totally.
So now,
really common sense, I would say.
Absolutely. All right. So now, I'm going to throw out a myth, and then we'll bust it on the other side of the break here because we're up against a break.
All right.
So now you've convinced me, Katie, I don't have to have just cactus and gravel in my front yard if I'm going to go, if I'm going to go regional appropriate. But I'm not really going to get much vibrant color, am I?
So some native plants do have a dormant period, which is often in the summertime. There are also many, many evergreen plants. So there's a lot of perennials, shrubs like your California buckwheat, manzanitas, sages. They can stay green throughout the whole year. But I also do want to kind of push back against that and say, you know, dormancy is a part of our seasons. A lot of people say Southern California doesn't have seasons. It's sunny all year. But really, the dry season is when we see a lot of changes. You'll notice a lot of the plants are turning kind of more brownish or grayish, losing some of their green. And that is an adaptation to the hot, dry season. That's them saving their water that they have stored.
Gotcha. So all right. All right. Like, well, I'm going to put a pin in it right there. We got to put a pin in it because you and I could just talk forever. We're going to pick this up on the other side of the break. You're going to finish telling us about dormancy and then about the vibrant colors that we can get as well with California natives. We're talking to Katie Tilford, certified horticulturist and executive assistant at the Theodore Payne Foundation. More about how to plant native when we come back. All right, we are in the middle of talking about the water crisis here in Southern California. Now we're on the flip side of that, talking about what we can do right from now forward into the future. And to help me with that, I've got an expert on the line, Katie Tilford, certified horticulturalist from the Theodore Payne Foundation, California's premier native plant nursery. More to talk to Katie about. Let's get her back. Katie, are you still there?
I'm here.
Okay, so before the break, we were talking about dormancy, that dormancy is a normal, natural part of, any seasonal plant life, and that we've got dormancy here as well, but that there are a lot of beautiful plants, a lot of them, here in Southern California that do well in Southern California that are evergreen year-round, and I wanted to get to this with you, colors, the kind of color variety that we can get.
Yeah, so there is a lot of variety throughout the year. If you plant different things, you'll have, maybe a ceanothus, the California lilac, blooming with bright blue flowers at the end of winter. And then going into, you'll have your purple flowered sage and your buckwheat starting to bloom. And then, end of summer, you can have a California fuchsia with bright red flowers. So there's really different colors popping up all throughout the year, and it gives you a sense of place and it gives you a sense of the season. So things are always changing in a native plant garden.
Exactly. I love that you said that. That's something that I just feel like a lot of people who born and raised in Southern California, like I am, we'll say, the weather's great. Everybody loves our weather, but we actually like the idea that, it'd be nice to have seasons, but California native plants actually do give you a sense of place and season.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, on the East Coast, the trees change colors and lose their leaves. And no one complains in the winter, oh my God, the trees are ugly. They just look like sticks right now. No, we appreciate that because it gives us a sense of what time of year it is and the season's changing. And so for us, basically summer is the season that a lot of our plants go dormant. They go to sleep. They stop growing. They take a little break and save their energy. I think it's just kind of a cultural shift that is going to happen. I don't have any doubt that that is going to happen. Just as people realize water is a finite resource and our landscapes can do something good for the environment instead of just being a drain on resources.
Exactly. Both from a resource perspective and from an artistic design perspective, what I've always encouraged people is, listen, we live in California. Be in California. Be here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be here.
Yeah.
Let's have this sense of place around us and embrace all the beauty that we can get out of it. Now, on top of that, let's talk about habitat for a second. Why should we embrace natives for the sense of habitat? What advantage does that give us?
So just as you were saying that, I just saw a monarch butterfly fly by. I'm outside in our garden right now. And a lot of animals, like those adult butterflies, are generalists, meaning they can feed on a lot of different plants. But then some animals, like their offspring, the caterpillars, which is their juvenile form, they are what we call specialists. So they require a specific plant that they have co-evolved with and adapted to eat over thousands to even millions of years. So if we wipe out all of those plants that the ecosystem depends on and replace them with ornamentals that don't really contribute anything back, then we're going to lose a lot of our insects, birds, pollinators like butterflies and bees. And we already have lost a lot of them. So that's kind of our goal. If you're proud to be a Californian, plant California native plants, and you'll see all of the wildlife coming back to life because you're creating connectivity between those habitats.
I think it's something that a lot of people just don't understand because, again, I don't know, maybe it's just something that we haven't taught. We haven't talked about enough. Yeah. But the idea of the connection between wildlife and plant life is inseparable. I mean, there is no disconnect between the two. And I just love that you brought this up. This I didn't even know. I knew about monarch butterflies and the caterpillars, but I never really thought of it in that sense, that the butterfly itself is a generalist. It can get by on a lot of different plants. And yet it goes through this phase when it's a caterpillar. I don't know if that's technically the larval stage, but as a caterpillar, it needs one plant and that's it. It needs a very, very specific plant.
The native milkweed, I just want to say, in case anyone's confused, it's the narrowleaf milkweed, or there's a few other native ones, but just not the tropical milkweed.
Now, why do you say not the tropical milkweed? Okay. Tropical milkweed, they come in different colors. They get sold at nurseries. What's the deal?
So the monarch butterfly, you know, it migrates. It goes on to from the West Coast down to Mexico. And our native milkweed is dormant in the winter. So right now you can be planting it, sowing the seeds. It'll grow. They will lay their eggs on it and the caterpillars will feed on it. But then in about November, December, when temperatures start cooling down, the plant will go dormant. It'll look like it's totally dead. And you can even cut back anything that's above the ground. But it will come back in the spring. So basically that signals to them, hey, you should be going on your journey and getting out of here. There's no food left. Move along. And that dormancy also prevents certain diseases from living on the plant more if you don't have the type that dies back.
So Katie, we are out of time. You and I, we could talk. You know what we have to do? We got to get you back on the show just to spend an entire program when we do our next landscaping program, just talking about all of the options. But the point is clear. The point is clear, everybody. We have options. And you know what? When we come back, we'll talk about exactly what those options are. Again, we'll do a lightning round of how to irrigate the new turning life here in Southern California and get over and through this water crisis that's facing us all. Katie, thank you for your time, buddy. I really appreciate it. We will be talking again very, very soon. You're home with Dean Sharp, the House Whisperer. Jane Yamamoto has the news. You are home with Dean Sharp, the House Whisperer. Hey, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us today. It's been a bit of a roller coaster ride with today's program because we've had some very important press conferences that we've had to break away from. I, of course, did a lot of prep, so I'm in the position of just distilling it down for you as tightly as possible. I wanted to spend today talking about our current water crisis right here in Southern California. We've had a couple of experts on, not only from the Metropolitan Water District talking about what the requirements are, but also from the Theodore Payne Foundation, a native plant nursery and educational center here in Southern California, talking about doing it right. So let me give you some highlights along the way. We're just going to do a little bit of a lightning round right here. The do's, the don'ts. I'm going to start with, you know what, let me do this. I'm going to start with the top-down approach. This is something that's outside of your and my control, except when it's time to vote and chime in on public policy issues, that kind of stuff. But let me just throw a couple of things out there for you. Just this week on Thursday, the California Coastal Commission decided the fate of the proposed Poseidon desalination plant in Huntington Beach, saying no. Now is not the time, at least for this plant at this time. A lot of you have asked me, what about desalination? I mean, the whole California coast is right next to the ocean, Dean. You know what? Desalination, it's an option. And it's a technology that's come a long way in the last 30, 40 years. It probably has a ways to go, but given the right environmental concerns and cares taking place, desalination is a way. But here is my issue with desalination. It's not about the technology or the plants or anything like that. It's about taking it as a shortcut so that we can just continue doing wrong what it is that we're doing wrong and not actually turn the corner. So I personally would rather see us invest infrastructure in getting some of the things right that we need to be doing and not just buying water from yet another source. And I'll give you two examples of that. The Hyperion plant near Dockweiler State Beach is LA's major sewage processing plant. It processes like 81% of the city's sewage. It discharges 190 million gallons of cleaned up water into a 5-mile outfall pipe in the Santa Monica Bay. Of all of that clean water that's going out there. Now, this is not the kind of water that is ready for drinking, but it is the kind of water that's ready for irrigation, okay? Irrigation, and irrigation's been our topic today in a lot of ways. Of that 190 million gallons a day, right, that plant right now, LA is recycling 2% of that water. Now, there is a plan in place, keep your ear to the ground, to recycle all of that by the year 2035. And in my opinion, that's a big thumbs up. Yeah, let's do that. Also, did you know the Great LA River? I know it's kind of a joke. The LA River is a storm drain. Do you know that when we have a couple of days of good rain, that, you know, we all hear some kids are fooling around in the LA River and they got to be rescued. That's because the LA River like fills up halfway. During just even 2 or 3 days of average rainfall here in LA. When it does that, you know that in a couple of days, there is enough runoff water flowing down the LA River, more than what Los Angeles would use in a year. Uh-huh, exactly. Currently, the runoff simply runs off. It just empties out into the Pacific Ocean. We touch none of it. We use none of it. We reclaim none of it. And so between the LA River and the water that we do get from rains here in Southern California and the Hyperion plant and some infrastructure changes there, we would find ourselves looking far, far better on our own water supplies. All right, that's the top-down stuff. Okay. That's apart from desalination. What is the bottom-up stuff? That's the you and me stuff. Well, let's go through it once again. Change out your eastern grass lawn. Don't just get rid of it and don't replace it with artificial turf. Removing living environment in Southern California is not the answer because real plants give off real moisture, cool our atmosphere, and cool our climate, even in microclimate conditions. So, artificial turf, not the answer, okay? But changing out eastern grass lawns to California native grasses or other drought-tolerant turf like Diamondia, Carapia, Lipia, UC Verde grass. You can go to ucverde.com to take a look at that. Native grasses that you can find at deltabluegrass.com. Go and take a look at those. And by the way, changing out those lawns during this crisis, just like the last drought crisis, there are rebates available. Do not immediately retreat to rock and cactus yards. Plant more trees. Yeah, trees. And this, you're going to find a big difference between the MWD's messages last time around and what you're hearing this time around. What you hear this time around is very specifically the MWD saying, listen, if you have to let something go brown, let the lawn go brown, but keep watering those trees. You know why? Because feature trees are the most important resource we have for cooling our environment and lowering the temperature and providing moisture in our air and recapturing groundwater in our environment. Trees, trees, trees. The largest ROI of anything that you can do to your house, period, is planting a feature tree. The biggest return on investment, immediate return on investment. So financially, it makes good sense. Environmentally, it makes good sense. And from an architectural design perspective, it makes brilliant sense. Plant more trees, okay? Plant native and drought-tolerant plants. Go to thetheodorepayne.org to learn more about it. Not only are they a nursery that will sell you plants and seed, but they also have classes that will teach you how to plant Southern California-ish planting. Lots of color, lots of beautiful stuff there. It goes without saying you drip irrigate everything, and you do it right in the middle of the night, not during the day. Change out your old sprinkler heads to rotary sprinkler heads. There are rebates for that. You can even go so far, and I'm going to talk about this when we come back, to do subsurface soaker systems for lawns. Get rid of the sprinklers altogether, completely gone. Okay. If you're not going to go that far, I want you to change out the old heads to rotary heads so that the water actually gets to the grass and not blow away in the wind. But when we come back, I'm going to talk to you about, for the first time in depth, subsurface soaker systems for lawns and why it is more than likely the future for all lawns in Southern California. That and more when we return. So glad you're with us. You're home with Dean Sharp, the House Whisperer. Jane Yamamoto has the news. Welcome home. Hey, my thanks to our great team here at KFI for navigating around all the bumps in the road this morning, all the changes, the press conferences, all of that, and still crank out a show worth listening to, I hope and pray. All right, I promised before the break that I would share one last thing with you, an idea that I hope that you all listen to very carefully. And I'm just going to give you a taster spoon of it right now. And that is this. When it comes to watering lawns, it's one thing. Change out the sprinkler heads, get better sprinkler heads, rotary heads that put out a solid stream of water instead of a spray mist. Da, 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 da. If you are really looking ahead into the 21st century and you really want to drought-proof and water crisis-proof your lawns and keep a lawn and keep it green, even, dare I say, oh, I hesitate to say this, even an eastern grass lawn, you should think about subsurface watering of that lawn. Now, what does that involve? It involves the same kind of flexible, like brown half-inch soaker lines with the little soakers built into them and the little filters built into them that you can find at the big box store, at your gardening center, at your local hardware store. Those same kind of inexpensive lines arranged in a coil pattern back and forth across the lawn, about 12 inches apart, staked down, and then having the turf, whatever it is, whatever form of sod or seed or whatever, placed on top of it. Ne'er again a sprinkler to sprinkle that lawn, all of it feeding the roots directly from underneath. What's the result? Even with eastern grasses, a 50% reduction in water use or more. Now, Dean, it's already too late. My lawn's already down. No, it's not. If you want to do this with your existing lawn, all you have to do is have a company come out, or you could try and do this yourself with a rental piece of equipment, but sod cut your lawn, set it aside, do the subsurface watering system, and then lay your sod back on in place. It's a lawnectomy-ish kind of a thing. Anyway, think about it. There's a billion YouTube videos about it. Check it out. And you know what? The reason I'm bringing it up is because of all the methods of watering turf in Southern California, this one is the smartest and the most economical and the most sustainable for the long term. And you'll never have to repair a sprinkler head again, by the way. All right. Well, it's been a roller coaster ride this morning. I am so glad you have stuck with us. I'm just going to leave you with this thought today. You know, whether it's news from back east about shootings and racial violence, whether it's the water crisis here, you know, it all ends up raising a question. Is human life sustainable? I mean, are we going to make it? Well, of course we are, but not without regard for where we are and how we live and how we choose to be. As I see it, our problem is that we usually don't listen first. Even though our fathers told us that God gave us two ears and only one mouth in order to listen twice as much as we talk, we still usually don't listen. And we seem compelled to follow those who don't listen either. I don't know why that is. Those we allow to lead us tend to be the folks who walk into a room and immediately begin to bend it to their will. They don't begin by listening to how things are or understanding how things work. They begin by telling us how things are going to be. They talk right over quieter things and walk right over quieter things because, damn it, we are doers and we are winners and we are not going to be caught flat-footed waiting around for someone or something else to make the first move and maybe get the upper hand on us. The stories we tell ourselves say a lot about how much we are listening. And despite the veneer of our bravado, how resilient a people we really are. Europeans came to this continent and called the indigenous people savages. Why? Let's be perfectly honest. Because the world would be too tough to figure out if they weren't. America grew its powerful economy on the backs of enslaved people because the world would be too tough to figure out if we didn't. For the longest time, women weren't fully equal people, and in some ways still aren't, because the world would be too tough to figure out if they were. And nearly everywhere, we've changed the physical ecology of that region to fit our way of living. Why? Because life would be too tough to figure out if we didn't. You know, when you're young, it's hard not to be in awe of world changers. I used to think that those people who constantly bent the world to their own will did so because they were so powerful. Now, I'm older. I wonder if those who bend the world to their own will, whether it be a country or an economy or a family or a relationship or a conversation or, yes, the environment, whether they feel the need to do so simply because they're just so powerful, or is it really that they're just too scared and too weak to accept things as they really are? I truly don't know the answer, but something inside me says it's an important question. Do we bend the world to make it better, or do we bend the world because life would be too tough to figure out if we didn't? I don't know. I've never had much success bending the world to my will, so I can't speak from personal experience. All I know is I've never regretted trying to listen before speaking, trying to understand before acting, and trying my best to embrace the world as it really is instead of clinging to stories that make me feel better. Change myself first, and then ask what needs to be done around me. Reality is almost always a tough pill to swallow, but in my view, it's always the best way to start building yourself a beautiful life. Everybody, have a great week. Feel free to email us questions about the water crisis if there was some detail that we didn't cover today. Otherwise, we will see you right here next weekend.